Today, the 2,000-year-old footprints in the sand.
The battle to save Ukraine's archaeology from destruction.
And...
yeah! Oh, that's great.
We're searching for rock art on Ilkley Moor.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams, where you can now get your hands on ad-free and sometimes bonus episodes as a Time Team member. And we did one, didn't we, a week or so ago, answering questions about our return to the Princely Burial Dig. And soon you'll be able to hear a bonus episode recorded at the current Archaeology Awards in London. To find out more about how your support directly funds the archaeology we do, head to patreon.com/Time Team Official.
Now, we've got an exciting episode ahead for you. Derek Pittman's down in Dorset at the moment, where part of the wreck of a ship was discovered on a beach at Studland Bay, something we talked about on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. You'll be hearing from Derek on that a little later to find out how it's all going. But it seems like everyone's in the business of discovering amazing archaeological treasures on beaches at the moment, because 500 miles north in Lunan Bay on Scotland's east coast, two dog walkers came across footprints in the sand that are now believed to be around 2,000 years old.
Yeah, and a big archaeological emergency rescue operation has been underway over the last few weeks to save them before they're washed away. Well, whose footprints are they? Let's find out some more with Professor Kate Britton from the University of Aberdeen, who's one of the team working on this incredible discovery. Kate, great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And how unusual are these footprints?
I mean, they're very, very rare. Footprints like this have not been recorded in Scotland before, so it's a new type site for us. There are a couple of patches in the UK that are quite famous for their footprints. There's the Formby Bay area in Merseyside and the Severn Estuary, which has a lot of sites like this. I've never worked on a site like this directly before, so a real archaeological first for me.
Brilliant. Well, what can you tell us about the footprints? Were they bare feet or was the person in shoes? And who would they have belonged to?
What we have is sort of exposed estuarine clays, and this is where the footprints are, that were previously covered over on the beach, but due to coastal erosion have since been exposed, and albeit quite fleetingly before they were then destroyed. The footprints are mostly from animals, although there are some human prints too. So far, I would say we've definitely got red deer and maybe roe deer and some other faunal species that we're working on identifying. And the human prints are indeed barefoot. The big toe often sticks out as one of the nice points for IDing what are essentially sort of oblong imprints, and also the arch in the midfoot. Many such footprints like this are often barefoot. For me, that makes perfect sense. It's a lot easier to clean a foot than it is to clean a shoe.
And how are you recording them? I mean, if they're here today and gone tomorrow, how do you make sure you've captured every detail for posterity?
Yeah, this was an incredible challenge. When we got this call from the county archaeologist quite late at night that these footprints had been reported to him and he asked us for help, we then immediately went to some of our colleagues elsewhere in Britain who have worked on these sites for help. So I was on the phone into the night to people I'd worked with over the years who I knew had worked on sites like this. So I got some really great specialist advice sort of straight from the horse's mouth. And we went out there with the aim of digitally recording them. So obviously digital technologies, 3D scans, using sort of drone-assisted photography was also very helpful. And we also used sort of more traditional techniques, things like plasticast pouring as well. The conditions were horrific. Certainly the first day it was like being sandblasted while we were trying to work. And it was really, I've never worked in conditions like that before. As soon as we were unearthing, you know, we were carefully removing the sort of loose sediments from the top of the footprints. And as soon as we're done that, we'd turn around to get the cameras and they'd be covered in another layer of sand. I had sand under my eyelids that night. It was horrendous. We couldn't get the drone up the first day, but the second day was much kinder to us. And then by the third day, the majority of the site had been destroyed and now it's completely gone. So the elements that gave us the site were really working against us. But yeah, with the mixture of those clement conditions in the middle and a lot of trips to garden centres and hobby stores to get the equipment we needed, we managed to hopefully get as much evidence as we could from the site to record it well and to take samples, things like tins with sediment samples in them, samples for possible OSL dating, radiocarbon dating, all of that, before it was all washed away.
You mentioned radiocarbon dating. I'm interested to know how you know these footprints are about 2,000 years old. How are you dating them?
The current sandy beach is backed by sand dunes, and underneath the sand dune is this eroding out clay layer. There's a land surface, and underneath that, these estuarine clays where the footprints are preserved, and that level is also also preserved horizontally as well as vertically, which is where we're seeing the footprints. We took a section out at the back, and that's where we got some exposed sediments. We're able to take some sediment samples from that, but we were also able to there step the profile and to see the footprints going into the section, which was really good because that's, you know, part of the compelling evidence that these are archaeological and not just, you know, somebody down there with a very heavy deer the previous day or something like that. And we were able to do a small test at the front of the site, so on that kind of horizontal plane towards the beach side, to also take sediments from there. And in both those profiles, we were lucky enough to get organics. So we got a date from sort of the base of these estuarine clays, which we think are in a sort of paleo channel of what would have been a salt marsh. And the base date was around 3000. And then the organics that were just underneath the footprints in that section were 2000. So that gives us a window of when that clay was being deposited. And the 2000 date is sort of the closest to that level with the footprints in it.
How much have you been able to reconstruct of the environment then?
Our first glimpses are obviously that we're dealing with sort of the environment when the footprints were made was quite different from today. It's a salt marshy environment, which is very different from the environment there today, which is a dune-topped sandy beach. What we're hoping is over the next coming months that our plant experts can look at the species in more detail and furnish this world a little bit more.
And who would these people have been then, the people who left the footprints? I mean, what was life like for people in that part of Britain 2,000 years ago?
The Lunan Valley and this part of Scotland in general has lots of evidence for people in the Iron Age. And we also, of course, have slightly later Pictish early medieval groups there. And what we can say for now is that these footprints are forming on or around or just after 2000 years ago, which sort of means any of those communities could be the agents, as it were. In the Lunan Bay area immediately, there's an Iron Age souterrain, there's an early medieval Pictish cemetery. So we've got snippets of what life would be like in that time in that specific area. But what I think is what really nice about this site is it gives us another idea of those of the kind of activities people would be engaged in, of those human environment interactions. We associate the Iron Age with things like agriculture, obviously, with animal husbandry, with growing crops. I love that this site is giving us an idea of that dynamic interaction between the wild environment of the salt marsh and people being down there, possibly for resource use, things like hunting or checking fish traps or maybe gathering wild plants in that area. And also, of course, that the contemporary animals were using that environment as well.
It's kind of obvious that people were moving around in the landscape. Human beings were moving around in the landscape, and wild animals would have been too. But to be able to see actual concrete evidence of exactly how that happened is so—it's so kind of grounding, isn't it? It takes your highfalutin ideas of what might have been going on and says, "No, this is real. These are real people that did real things," and it captures our imagination in a way that almost nothing else can.
It's such a tangible link to the past. I mean, as an archaeologist, I work a lot with human remains, and many of the sort of people I meet in the past are dead. I know that sounds like a really obvious point to make, but I'm used to, you know, I work with human remains very often. It's really interesting here to get this insight to dynamic activity, to activity, the physicality of people in the past. And I think this is why the footprint sites are so evocative and so tangible and so captivating. But for me, with my sort of environmental archaeology, human environmental interactions hat on, again, it's very interesting to see activity down in these natural spaces as well. This is a really nice snapshot of activity in a landscape that might not normally be represented. And I think that's the real academic value in it, as well as there being just that lovely link to individual people and to individual animals and to actions in the past.
Well, that's brilliant, Kate. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us on the podcast about it. And the take-home message then is watch out, all beachcombers. You might be standing on something incredible.
Yep, you never know.
It's now 4 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. During that time, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed or wounded, and countless homes and buildings have been destroyed.
Despite the danger, experts with military assistance have been doing their best to save some of Ukraine's most important archaeological sites and finds before they're destroyed by advancing troops or missile attack.
Pavlo Shidlovsky is head of Department of Archaeology and Museum Studies at Taras Shevchenko National University of Kyiv and has worked with colleagues around the world to document Russian crimes against Ukrainian archaeological heritage. Pavlo, really great you're able to join us today on the podcast. Thank you. I wonder if we could start by talking about how at risk archaeology in Ukraine is as a result of the war.
To answer your question, it's a question simple and from the other side much complicated, because in fact we have not a simple war between two states. We have a war for culture. We have a war for history and for historical identity of Ukrainians itself. Because one of the main aim of our Putin's war is to erase Ukrainian history and to erase Ukrainian identity. In this situation, culture, Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian historical objects became a special target. A lot of archaeological collections were just stolen by our enemies. It documented by many video and photo materials, which there was a regular robbery of archaeological collections. That is not a full list of war crimes. We speak about also excavations as legal, so-called legal, because it's not legal excavation can be on occupied territories. But we know that on the territory of occupied Crimea, we have regularly excavations of archaeological teams from Russia. And also we have an illegal excavation, so-called black archaeologists or just robbers in the so-called gray zone. We have a well-trained special groups which have their illegal excavations on the mass scale, because on a vast territory we have no police, have no official administration, and that is a possibility even under the rocket fire, under the rocket attacks, bombing and so on. These well-trained special groups made their work, so they just come to go to archaeological site and take all on this territory which they want. And of course, it's not connected to maybe to territories, to frontline territories, but all the territory of Ukraine for the moment is like a network of fortification system. Fortification systems mainly made, produced on the outstanding points of landscape. And in this case, hill forts, burial grounds, burial mounds, ditches and different walls and so on. All territory of Ukraine was covered by the network of these trenches, dugouts, military positions and so on. But it was the reflection, it was like a reaction on the mass scale invasion. So we did such dugouts, such trenches as, of course, as a reaction for protecting human lives and protecting human homes.
It all sounds so upsetting. fascinating. And obviously, the protection of human life is always going to be, you know, the people who are still alive are always more important than the archaeological people who are dead. But is there anything that you can do to fight against all this horror of damage and destruction?
First of all, for me, as for a teacher and as archaeologist, first of all, there was an idea we need to record the damage. We focused on the outstanding sites, so such as sites which are known for Ukrainian archaeology and which is simple to understand to mark the landscape, such as hill forts and such as walls, Scythian walls and burial mounds and so on. These hill forts, which was built in 10th, 11th century, today also were used for protecting city of Kyiv. So it's like a reusing of landscape for modern war. It's a big problem for archaeology at all. Yes, of course, because these points of landscape were damaged by our troops, first of all. But in the second turn, it was damaged by enemies because they tried to beat our troops, which make their positions in this hill fort. But it's like a maybe tradition to use such points of landscape for protecting our city, Kyiv. We create archaeological landscapes monitoring group, and we start to write letters to military persons who are responsible for that or that territory to ask them permits. Let us come to you and look for the archaeological objects. So it was the first. It was made in autumn of 2022. First attempts, first groups for recording of archaeological damage.
And Pavlo, why do you feel that people in Ukraine and the archaeology community in Ukraine is supportive of this? Why is this something that Ukraine as a country, which is at war at the moment, feels it's important to do?
When you see such destructions in the mass scale, you begin to understand the importance that it is not yours, it's a common value. Such as nature and heritage and history and so on. I think that citizens in Ukraine started to feeling like this. They started to feeling the importance of these common values. Now we have a peak of activity of different volunteer organizations which are trying to record damage, and not only to record damage, mostly their activity focused on safeguarding in terms of digitizing and so on. This means that this part of social activity became important for Ukrainians.
You have given us so much to think about, Pavlo, and I'm really grateful to you for taking the time with all that you have to do to come onto the podcast and tell us about it, because it, on the one hand, it's very inspiring. On the other hand, it is really, really upsetting. And just to hear about your experience is really powerful. So thank you very much.
To the beautiful moorland of West Yorkshire. Now, great for going hiking, mountain biking, or maybe enjoying a family picnic. But as Time Team's Giselle Kirai's been finding out, it's also the perfect place to see some of the oldest artwork in the country. If only you could actually find it.
I'm here on Ilkley Moor. Now, this is a beautiful place that's covered in ferns, covered in heather, and secretly hiding rock art. Now, what is rock art? Well, rock art is something that was made thousands of years ago in prehistoric times, made with a hammer stone and pecking at a rock until it created these abstract art pieces. You've got cup markings, you've got cup and ring markings. These different bits of art you can find on panels all over Ilkley Moor. Hundreds and hundreds of them. I think there's about 400 panels here on this moor. Now, who did this? Well, experimental archaeology has occurred to figure out who might have done this, and we've got men, women, young, old, all able to make rock art. It doesn't matter your strength. Now here, if you look around, there's loads of heather, there's loads of ferns. How in the heck are we going to be able to find any rock art here? Well, I've got, thankfully, my phone, which has OS Maps on it, and I've been able to put in input into it different locations for where we could possibly get some rock art. So I'm gonna go have a look, see what I can find. Okay, I think there might be one just over there. There's like a panel that I can just barely see, and it potentially matches the location on my OS map, so I think we should go have a look. Yeah! Oh, that's great. This has a lot of stuff on it, actually. We've got some cut marks here. There's a groove there. And then if we go further this way, this is like a cup with, maybe it's like a half ring, I can't really tell. But this here is a cup with what looks like a ring around it. So this is a pretty good start for the first bit of rock art we've seen.
And my discoveries didn't stop there. Well hidden by the heather was an example of rock art, which gives some clues as to how it might have been created.
Yeah, there's some peck marks on this one. There's some pecking. So we've just come across a rock art panel here that's got some proof of pecking, which are these little tiny marks made when the hammer stone was used to actually carve out these rock art carvings. So we can actually see little tiny peck marks all throughout these little bits here. It's really, really cool. I've never actually seen this before, so this is really neat to stumble upon. I'm keen to learn more, so I'm meeting up with Tom Bell, who's an expert in rock art.
What we've got here on Oakley Moor are late Neolithic to early Bronze Age markings into the rock. They would have been pecked in using a hammer stone, and they would have made these nice abstract shapes, and we have hundreds of them across the moor.
So do we know anything about who made these or how long it would take to make any of these cut markings?
No, it's really difficult to know about who made them, but what we do know is how long it would have taken to make one. There's been experimental archaeology done, and using different hammer stones and different rock, we estimate it would take between half an hour and 1.5 hours to make one of these.
So we have all of these bits of rock art, but is there any way we can date them? How do we know that they're prehistoric?
These are really difficult to date. Most of it's been done by using either things in the vicinity, artifacts found nearby, or we're going off general typology. What are the shapes that have been carved? So it's really difficult for us to understand what the motifs might mean, but maybe it's more important to look at why they are carved, not what is carved.
Is this something that's a normal spot for rock art to be, this panel up here? I've seen some on hillsides in Scotland, and this now we're on a plateau. Is this a normal place for rock art to be found?
Yeah, this is fairly normal. The ones in Scotland are usually marking either a viewpoint or a water source. They're marking entrances and exits to glens and usually along the edges of the lowlands there.
I imagine that pecking this with a hammer stone would have made a loud sound. So if you're in these valleys or anything like that, or even up here, it would have made a loud sound. Am I on the right track at all?
Yeah, a lot of the panels are in places where the sound would have reverberated. It would have attracted people. And one of the interesting parts in Scotland, they found a quartz hammer stone. Now, when that would have hit the rock, it would have created bright sparks. So not only are you getting the sound, but you're getting light show as well.
So here on Ilkley Moor, so many people are walking past these and they don't even know that they're passing rock art. Is there a way to tell? Because to me, some of these divots, I don't know if I could tell the difference between a cut marking and just a natural divot in the stone. Is there a secret to it?
Now, with the cut marks, it can be quite difficult. Sometimes you get little marks made by gas coming out, but usually you're looking for it to be nice and smooth and regular. Obviously, it's a lot easier looking at these cup and ring marks because you're not going to get anything like that occurs naturally.
So looking at this landscape, there's so many stones that are hidden by heather. How can people possibly find them all? How do you know what they mean or anything like that?
Well, that's true, and there's probably hundreds that we haven't found here. Now, an interesting place is on the North York Moors, where there was a moorland fire, and that allowed archaeologists to uncover 180 panels of rock art. Now, these were all mapped out, and they proved to be along routeways through the moor, and especially at important places like Waterway, one where it was really difficult to cross, one of the only possible crossing places, was marked by a stone with 8-cut marks on it.
Well, thanks for that, Tom. I'm now going to go see if I can find some more. So I've been walking out here for a bit now, and Ilkley Moor is just such a special place. I keep coming back here and keep looking for more rock art, and today we found quite a bit, which has been really great. And I hope that people can come out here and they can enjoy this rock art as well. And, you know, you can move the heather about a little bit, you can check OS maps to try and figure out where some of this rock art is, but there's certain rock art to look out for. So, cut marks. Those are kind of the main ones we've been seeing. Then you've got a cup and a ring. You've got cup ring with a line in it. Sometimes you just get abstract ones with random grooves or lines just sort of wiggling their way around the rock. And sometimes you can even find ones that look a bit like a palmier. And you can look for these basically on any of these rocks, just see if you can find them. And if you do, you can upload them to a system and help create a map of all of this for future archaeologists. I've had a great time out here on Ilkley Moor. It's been really special getting to walk in the same steps as people from thousands and thousands of years ago. And you can do it too. All you have to do is look up where these locations might be, and you can come out to Ilkley Moor and you can look for these bits of rock art. It's so fun rummaging around in the heather and the ferns looking for something. So, see if you can find any yourself.
Now, this is really fascinating. That artwork is so widespread, yet so little is known about it. You find cup and ring marks all across Europe. It's kind of Scandinavia to the Mediterranean. So if they're marking boundaries and travel routes, what does that mean about the movement of people and so on? And, I found myself wondering what they look like when it's raining, or when it's just stopped raining and the rock's drying out, or what about in full sun, or what about full sun at sunset or sunrise? I mean, I think that's where everybody's observations, everybody's photos come in. That's another aspect of citizen science. Everybody can get involved.
Now, a few days ago, Helen and I were hobnobbing, weren't we, Helen, at the Current Archaeology Awards in London. And a big congratulations, I should say, as well, to all of the winners at that event. We recorded an episode of the podcast there, and you'll be able to hear that in about, I think, a couple of weeks' time. If you're a Time Team member, you'll also be able to listen to the bonus episode that we recorded at the awards as well. So many interesting people to speak to. It is definitely worth a listen. As a Time Team member, though, you don't just get extra stuff from the podcast. There's also the behind-the-scenes films, masterclasses like the one on geophysics, which is being published in installments at the moment. Very interesting it is as well. There's 3D models. There's the chance to join us on digs. And, of course, all of our content ad-free. Head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for more information.
Now, 2 weeks ago, we told you about a missing piece of the Swash Channel shipwreck, which turned up on a beach in Dorset during a storm. It's almost certainly the Fame from Hoorn, an armed Dutch merchant ship that ran aground and sank in 1631.
Yeah, and we had Tom Cousins on, didn't we? A maritime archaeologist who's part of the team that's been rescuing the wreck from the beach. Well, another person who's been helping is Time Team's very own Derek Pittman from Bournemouth University. Derek, how's it going then?
It's going very well. What a lovely couple of weeks I've had playing around on a beach. It's been magnificent.
So what have you been up to?
So it's a strange one, really. I can take no credit for anything, and I'm just going to say that in massive block capitals here. I'm very lucky in that I happen to live fairly close to where the bit of wreck was found. And on the day it was found, I don't know if Tom told you this, but it's quite a funny story. Tom was doing a book launch for the Swash Channel Wreck book, and he got a text message saying, "We found a bit more," which about that same time, I was probably getting numerous messages from people around the area because they know I'm an archaeologist. They know I live in Purbeck, saying, "There's a bit of a shipwreck on a beach. You've got to get down and see it." So I kind of heard about it on the grapevine that night. And then the next day I had a message from Tom saying, "Oh, we're going to go and have a look. Do you want to come and join us?" For no reason other than the fact he knew I'd be interested and he knew I'd come over and have a peek.
So what's this rescue process involved then? Because the wreck itself now has been removed from the beach, hasn't it?
Yeah, so for me, it was a fascinating process because, I mean, I'm a bog standard terrestrial archaeologist. I'm used to taking lots of time over things, having lots of kind of build up, lots of planning. And this was a fairly rapid process. So it was only really a week ago that the wreck was identified. And the first day we went down with Tom, it was a surreal experience in that the excavation tools were beach spades from bucket and spade sets, which was wonderful to see. But I suppose it's the natural thing to dig in beach sand with. So we exposed the wreck on that first day, had a good look at it. And Tom and some of the National Trust team down there were getting quite excited because there were certain indicators. I think the tree nails are the thing they were getting most excited about. It was quite apparent as the tide came back in that this wreck was exposed. It's no longer protected by the sand where it's been buried for 400 odd years. If it's not recovered safely, it's only going to get eroded and essentially lost to the sea again. So Tom and Dave Parham from Bournemouth were kind of debating what best to do with it. And at the time, the main strategy was to cover it in sandbags to protect it, keep it nice and safe on the beach, and then ideally come back in the future at some point and recover it and take it back for conservation and study. And all of a sudden, within a few days, Tom sent me a message saying, National Trust have some cash floating around. I'm not sure I'm allowed to say that, but the National Trust have some funding. They'd like to rescue it and recover it as soon as possible. We're going down to do it next Thursday. Do you want to come along? Of course I do. Yes. So I went along, and again, I can take very little credit. I was mostly floating around with a camera, capturing little bits and pieces and occasionally helping out when needed. It was so good to watch because, again, I'm used to kind of tickling the ground with a trowel ever so gently and sort of pulling up a tiny fragile bit of ceramic or something quite delicate. And this was not delicate at all. And rightly so, I should point out, in that the urgency was to get it off the beach and get it protected. But maritime archaeology is a very different business to terrestrial archaeology. And at one point, there were sledgehammers, there were handsaws, there was a whole litany of tools to disassemble it in the right places so it can be reassembled later. So it was an incredible thing to watch.
So what's going to happen to it now?
Ultimately, Tom and the crew at MAST, which is a charity around maritime archaeology that we work with at BU, they will build a special tank which it'll get soaked in so that it will the salt water in there will eventually get replaced by, I want to say, clean water before being maybe impregnated with resin. I'm not 100% sure on that. Please write in and correct me if I'm wrong, maritime archaeologists. And at that point, I think the ambition is to reassemble it and place it in the museum alongside the other elements of the swash. But in the kind of intermediate times, getting a dendrochronological date, that's easy for me to say, is kind of top of the research agenda, so they can confirm that it comes from that same tree cutting as the dendro dates they've got on the rest of the ship.
So essentially what's going to happen to it is on a small scale what has happened on a big scale at the Mary Rose.
Yeah, exactly that. So yeah, they will do what they can to protect and preserve it. And there's already some lovely bits of the fame from Horn or of Horn. I'm never too sure how to introduce the ship. But the Swash Channel wreck on display in Poole Museum, the rudder, this really ornate carved rudder, is already on display there. And they've got a wonderful space in that museum now. Viewers who have watched our recent video on the medieval wreck in Poole Harbour will know there's a dedicated maritime space in that museum where it's pretty much a museum of Tom Cousins, in that almost everything in there he's found, recovered, excavated or brought up. So I think the anticipation is it will go alongside the other bits of the Swash wreck in there and sort of take its rightful place on display.
Brilliant. And it just goes to show, doesn't it, that because we talked about this today, we've also talked about those 2,000 year old footprints that were found on a beach. It's sort of the weather, the elements give with one hand in that they expose this amazing history and archaeology, but also they take with another in that you've got to move quick.
It's a massive challenge, and I think that's what struck me most with this was the kind of, it was very much a team effort with folks from the National Trust, loads of students. We had some a group of sixth form folks as well watching and taking part in the process, but it was definitely a all hands on deck, get in there, protect it as quickly as you can. But what kind of struck me when I was kind of witnessing this event and looking at the erosion on the coast as I walked out, and the fact that it was a whopping great storm that moved enough sand to be able to see this. It must have been a fairly similar storm to the storm that beached the ship in the first place. And it's got that kind of nice circularity to it of a storm puts it there and then a storm finds it again 400 years later.
Yes, but I think the thing is about storms these days is that in the past they were relatively rare major events, and now we're having them so frequently, and that's the new reality that we're going to have to get used to if we're going to be able to adapt.
I think that's true, and certainly chatting to some of the folks from the Trust down there, we were chatting about some of their other heritage sites in the area and the risk from storms, particularly those sites that are quite close to cliffs, and I think there's an awful lot of heritage at risk from the changing climate as it is at the moment. And while, yes, it may give us a nice insight into a shipwreck, it may also destroy a significant amount.
Yeah, the changing world in which we live. But on this occasion, it's proved invaluable for learning about the archaeology and the history of that amazing ship. Derek, I'm glad you were there. Brilliant to hear what you were getting up to, having a nice time on a windswept beach. And thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's been a busy episode today. Thank you very much for being with us, watching or listening. We're back next week when I'll be answering some of the questions suggested by Time Team members. There are questions on how you might furnish an ancient house and what Time Team archaeologists do for work when they're not on a Time Team dig.
Yeah, all of those questions. Plus, of course, Helen's going to be telling you about an archaeological find that will amaze and intrigue you. That is all next week. So we'll speak to you on the next Time Team podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.